Today in Studio 360...
Seems that's what I was always doing now, chasing the moon.
A new novel for children finds the poetry in methamphetamine.
Trying to catch the high, trying to hold on to it, trying to step deep into it and disappear.
I'll talk with the author of Beneath a Meth Moon, Jacqueline Woodson.
I needed to be able to have the reader go in a way that feels safe and kind of almost swaddling.
For the writer Pico Iyer, there's almost nobody he feels closer to than the novelist Graham Greene, whom he never met.
There must be some deeper sense of connection, almost as if he was scripting my life or I was stumbling through one of his novels.
And does the Webb Enterprise Kickstarter make government arts funding obsolete? That and more ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today on the show, I will talk with the writer Pico Iyer. For the last 25 or 30 years, he's felt a deep and almost mystical connection to the work and life of the writer Graham Greene.
He never seemed comfortable in any category. Whatever box you would try to impose on him, he would wriggle out of. And I share that sense of not wanting to inhabit any category.
So much so, he just wrote a whole book about it called The Man Within My Head. That's later in the show, but first, let's talk about how culture gets paid for. For most of the last half century, one of the big possibilities was the National Endowment for the Arts, the federal government's NEA. The NEA's pot of money has shrunk over the years. It's $146 million this year. But a new crowdfunding website is picking up some of that slack. You've probably heard of it. It's called Kickstarter. Right now at Kickstarter.com, thousands of people are pledging money, big and small amounts, to all kinds of creative projects. Last week, a web comic book raised $1 million. So could Kickstarter or something like it ever replace the NEA? Not so fast, according to Clay Johnson. He is the author of the new book, The Information Diet, and he thinks comparing Kickstarter to the NEA is apples and oranges. No, worse.
It's really apples and spaceships. I mean, they do entirely different things.
Well, what got this whole conversation going was one of Kickstarter's founders recently bragging about how they were about to distribute more money to the arts and arts projects this year than the NEA. When you saw that, what was your reaction?
That doesn't sound right. And so I went and looked at the top 10 projects that they brought in and tried to sum up all the different categories of money. And it just didn't seem like they had really spent nearly as much money as they'd claimed to on core arts. Now, I went back and forth with them on my blog and on theirs, and it turns out they gave around $64 million, I think, to what we would consider to be core arts funding in 2011.
Tell our audience a little more about how Kickstarter works. I know they take a 5% cut out of all project monies for themselves. But otherwise, what is the deal?
Basically, what happens is if you want to make a film or if you want to, you know, make a record album or something like that, you can go onto Kickstarter and say, I want to make this album. Here's some maybe samples of my work. Usually it's a very well-produced video. And then you say, look, can all of you chip in? I need $50,000 to make it. Here's some rewards if you pledge. You know, I don't know if there's any NPR tote bags involved, but there's something
it
involved.
It is a bit of a public radio model, isn't it?
Sort of, except it's an all or nothing game, right? So if you don't raise the funds that you need, all of the funds that you need, you get nothing.
Right.
And it costs the pledger nothing. But the other part of this is, I mean, I don't want to get into a what is art discussion,
right,
but a couple of weeks ago, someone just got $1 million for creating a better dock for the iPhone. and someone else has a sensor that you can put on top of your dryer that'll send you a text message when your dryer's off. And it does a bunch of other things, too. But I pledged to that project not because I wanted to be supportive of the arts. I pledged to that project because I can't hear my dryer, right? And I wanted that product. And in some ways, not for everybody, but in some ways, Kickstarter is a lot more like shopping than it is the NEA, where the NEA isn't necessarily worried about giving the taxpayer back, you know, art directly for their investments.
No. And I want to make a point that we, in full disclosure, Studio 360 gets some small part of its funding from the NEA. But to play a bit of a devil's advocate, if I were a boundaries pushing theater, let's say, and I wanted to create some show that I knew could cause problems for me when certain people in Washington heard about it and I was getting funding from the NEA, it would feel a lot better to have my fans or my patrons and my supporters through a Kickstarter paying for it than the federal government.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at it like that, sure, and it gets you access to a crowd. I think it's an excellent supplement to a lot of things. You know, if I was a TV writer who was constantly getting his shows canceled, like a Joss Whedon or something like that, I'd definitely go to Kickstarter and try and, you know, fund my next project through there and see if I could go straight to the internet.
As a former member of the Obama for President campaign, does it particularly worry you that in 2012 this is coming up in the midst of the crazy winds of a political year?
That's my chief concern, yes. It's, you know, conservatives aside, it's more about people going, well, then we don't need the NEA. When the important thing about art is that, you know, art can't be determined by what's popular. If we only make art that's popular, then, you know, the guy who made the dogs playing poker smoking cigars print is going to be the most popular and successful.
Hey, don't put that down. I love that art.
Well, we all have different tastes.
Yes. Leaving aside the NEA, are you hopeful about the Kickstarter model, whether it's Kickstarter or other versions, being a source for sort of cultural funding of various kinds?
What's really great about Kickstarter is that you can fund local projects. You can drill down and say, you know, I live in Washington, D.C., so I can I helped to fund a sock puppet show of Into the Woods at a local community theater, which was a lot of fun. And it was a great show. And it was just some people who wanted to express themselves and do some art. It was a little crazy, but it was good.
So your $50 paid for the whole show, I guess, probably.
Yeah, right. Well, that's a lot of socks.
Yeah. Clay Johnson, thank you very much.
Enough.
Thank you.
It's definitely Suck It to Me time.
Clay Johnson is the author of the new book, The Information Diet. So what do you think? Is Kickstarter the wave of the future? Should it or something like it replace the NEA?
Oh, suck it to me, baby.
Tell us at studio360.org. Jacqueline Woodson is one of the most acclaimed and successful writers of fiction for kids and young adults around. But her books aren't about vampires or werewolves or super rich kids. Since young people's real lives are complicated, Woodson thinks they can handle complicated characters and stories. Her books have dealt with teen pregnancy and gender identity. And in her latest novel, drug addiction. It's called Beneath a Meth Moon.
Seems that's what I was always doing now, chasing the moon, trying to catch the high, trying to hold on to it, trying to step deep into it and disappear.
It's the story of a girl named Laurel, a 15-year-old whose life has been ravaged by Hurricane Katrina. She's lost her home, her mother, her grandmother, and in her grief, she starts using meth and quickly gets addicted.
My whole body felt like someone was dipping me in ice water and leaving me in there only long enough to feel the pain, then pulling me out again. Even my brain hurt, but when I tried to cry, no tears came, just deep hunger for the moon.
That's from Jacqueline Woodson's novel Beneath a Meth Moon. Jacqueline Woodson, welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks for having me.
The name you use for meth, moon, where'd you get that?
I made that up. I wanted to...
It's so poetic, maybe almost glorifying.
Oh, now when you get deep
into it, that's true.
It's very scary. I mean, it's about that. It's about the attraction and the beauty and what it looks like from afar, and then how quickly it takes charge and devastates.
And growing up in the 80s with heroin and other drugs around you, were you tempted? Did you indulge? Were drugs part of your life as a kid?
Oh, you know, my family was Jehovah's Witnesses. So
probably not.
So you do the opposite of what
oh,
they say.
I see.
But they
did you go door to door?
I went door to door.
I probably slammed the door on you.
I know. A lot of people look familiar now that I'm an adult. But I definitely, you know, I tried weed. I drink wine. But I was always scared of the harder stuff. But I was a kid growing up in the city, so I wasn't going to not do anything.
Her addiction involves physical deterioration. Her skin gets bad, or her fingers turn yellow. She breaks a tooth. Those very graphically described features of it would seem to be a way to scare a certain fraction of your readers off ever doing this, right?
I hope so. It definitely, I would be
scared. Preteen girls, in my experience, are kind of vain.
They are, and in this regard, I hope they stay that way. I hope they stay as vain as they are. And I think Laurel just kind of stopped caring, and my hope is that others don't.
So here you have a novel about drugs and drug addiction. You've written about sexuality as well. What muse are you serving by writing about these sort of dangerous subjects?
It's so funny because I don't think of them as dangerous. I think of them as, I write realistic fiction, and these are things that happen to people all the time. And so, and for me, the heart of the story is how people live with and through stuff. So I do challenge myself to write about what's real and what's important and to some extent, what impacts a greater good, what matters. And this is stuff that I think really matters.
Laura likes to write, and she fills notebooks with observations of the real world, of imagined worlds. Was that you at her age?
I've known I wanted to be a writer since I was 7. So
what happened at 7?
At 7, I think it was realizing that you put letters together and they made words, and you put words together and they made sentences, and that seemed infinite to me, and that seemed so powerful. And I don't know what turned that on. I don't know if it was something that I was born with, but there was some desire to do that always. And at that point, it was the physical act of writing.
Huh.
And then it became telling stories. I love stories. I loved hearing them. I love lying. And it was amazing to me that you could do this. And I grew up during a time where, you know, you didn't meet authors and you didn't have the internet or any of that way of accessing the people who made the books. But I knew that this is what I wanted to do.
When did you read a book that made you think, whoa, this is really what I want to do?
I think the first one was Little Match Girl. And I think it was my third grade teacher reading it to us. And the point where she dies at the end was just kind of amazing to me. And it was amazing how devastating it was and how I could still get up and go home. And so there was something really powerful about that, about being able to be in the world of this story and then leave it and still be safe. And I remember, you know, wanting to do that, wanting to tell those kind of stories. And then the next one was Selfish Giant, Oscar Wilde's The Selfish Giant, that kind of did the same thing. And I think that was my transition from the Happily Ever After stories that I had been read to like, wait, real things can happen and we can be okay.
That's so interesting because so much of the default reflex, it seems, with children's books is that, no, don't expose them to these unhappy, horrible things, right? I mean, and here you are at third grade being inspired by that entirely unreal story in which...
Yeah, I think it's more the adults that are afraid of going to those places. The kids haven't been there yet, so they don't know to be wary of them. And of course, they're the kids who want the fantasy and want the happily ever after, and they're the kids who want the more real stuff. But I think it's important that I think kids compartmentalize so they can take what they can take in and disregard the rest.
You write for very little kids too, and even picture books. You do. Do you feel as though you have a special knack for writing for very young people?
I think the reason I really love doing it is because it's the part of my memory that's most clear. It's the part I can go back to being 4 and 5 and remember things that happened, or remember feelings, or 15 or 12. And I think a lot of people I think the young adult years and the adolescent years were really painful, so they shut them down. And
right.
So they can't go back and access them, and I didn't because, you know, even if they were painful, they still were, so.
So the intensity that most people sort of muddy up, you kept crystal clear.
It's very clear.
You have 2 kids, a son and a daughter. How old are they now?
My son just turned 4, and my daughter's about to turn 10.
Has having kids changed the way you write for kids?
I think, with the exception of Beneath a Meth Moon, my writing's gotten funnier. And I think...
Because they're funny or because it's fun to make children laugh?
Because they make me laugh. They definitely make me laugh. So, and they make me kind of take life just a little less seriously than I did before.
That's interesting. Since, of course, what people say about having children is it makes them take life more seriously than they ever did before.
Why?
Because they have a stake in the world and something to live for and something to, you know, they have a foot in the next century or whatever.
But they should have had that before they had kids.
Well, I'm just telling you what is probably more common than saying having children makes me take life less seriously. But good for you. If your publishers came to you and said, okay, Jacqueline, we love your work, but how about, do you have any ideas for an adult novel? Would you like that? Would you say, nah, I'm happy to write for kids?
I wrote an adult novel years ago called Autobiography of a Family Photo, and I liked the experience of being in that world. I didn't love it. It's interesting because I do get people saying, oh, do you ever plan to write for adults? And I always say, do you ever plan to write for children? You know, because I think there is a misconception about the ease with which we can do this.
Well, which has been exacerbated the last decade by various celebrities, including presidential candidates' wives, publishing children's books as though it's, you know, baking some cookies. I mean, that's not necessarily good for the guild, is it?
Well, I think for the most part, the people in the know ignore those books. And I think the thing that can happen that's really scary is it becomes the book that gets recognized that the grandparent will buy for the grandchild or the parent will buy for the grandchild.
Do I want the Madonna book or the Calista Gingrich book?
And then then the child will read it and say, I don't like this book. I don't like reading. And so there's one person. She's actually a celebrity who writes really well. So
not Jamie Lee Curtis. No.
Yes, Jamie Lee Curtis. I like her work.
Well, there you go. She's a smart person.
Yeah.
You are still in your 40s, but you've published almost an uncountable number of 20 something books, 30 books.
Yeah.
With that output, do you worry about repeating yourself in terms of ideas, incidents, plots, anything?
No. I think I worry more about expectation. I think, you know, when I get awards and stuff, and there's this great part in a Joni Mitchell concert when she says, everyone's always telling her to sing Circle Game, and she says, no one asked Van Gogh to paint a starry night again. And I think that fear that someone's going to say, paint a starry night again, write a book just like that book, or you got the Newbery for that book, so give us another Newbery. And that kind of stuff I have to kind of shut off and think, all of that stuff that I got was for that book. It has nothing to do with what I want to do here, and I'm doing something completely different here.
Jacqueline Woodson, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. This was fun.
Beneath a Meth Moon is just out, and you can hear Jacqueline Woodson read from the book at studio360.org. Coming up, picture a tree, its trunk, branches going off in different directions. Got that in your head? Well, then you've also got a pretty good image of a new law of physics. It's a fresh way of thinking about how the world is designed.
Think of the air passages in the human lung.
Tree-shaped.
Electrical power grids.
Tree-shaped.
Roads and highways.
The vascularization of the retina. The
snowflakes?
Yes, it is the same with the growth of any snowflake.
Discovering the deep design of nature. That's in a minute in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Over the last 16 years, a mechanical engineer has been working on a theory for how the world works. It's called constructal law. And lately, amazingly, it's been accepted as a new law of physics. The law's fundamental idea is this: everything that moves, whether animate or inanimate, a speck of dust or you, is a flow system. And things that flow always want to flow better. The similar shapes of tree branches and rivers are one way to illustrate this idea. But Studio 360's Jonathan Mitchell thinks he's got an even better way. As part of our series on science and creativity, Mitchell met the man who came up with this new law of design in nature.
In 1995, a mechanical engineering professor was sitting in the audience at a science conference in Nancy, France. If you happened to be sitting next to him, he might have introduced himself.
I'm Adrien Bejean. I'm a professor at Duke University.
And speaking at the podium was Ilya Prigozhin,
the Nobel Prize laureate for chemistry in 1977.
He was talking about trees and river basins and lightning.
And he made the statement that these architectures are purely the result of throwing the dice.
Any similarities among trees and river basins and lightning, he said, were just coincidence. And that's when Bejean had an insight.
The flash in the dark.
That would change the course of his career.
What he said struck me as wrong.
At the time, Bejean had been working on new designs for cooling electronics.
Drawings for how to suck heat out of a laptop.
And his drawings all looked like...
like trees. They looked like the river basin. Those drawings I have, I had them on my table before I went to this conference in France. And they were not the result of throwing any dice. I was getting my trees by invoking the principle that later I baptized as the constructal law.
The constructal law is all about the way things flow. It says that any flow system will, over time, shape itself to flow more easily.
That is the principle. And it is a first principle. It is a statement that cannot be deduced from existing statements.
So, for example, imagine the life of a river basin.
While the rain continues to fall on the plain, the river basin constantly morphs.
Rocks and mud get washed away.
It contorts itself. It corrects its mistakes. The flowing design flows better, more easily.
And eventually, it forms a pattern that's shaped sort of like a tree.
That's why on the map of the United States, we are accustomed to seeing the drawing of the Mississippi River Basin. In reality, that is not a static drawing. That is a dynamic, a morphing animal which is called the Mississippi Flow, which is from an area, a huge area, to one point.
And the constructal law says that tree design emerges naturally.
When the flow connects one point with an infinity of points.
And we see this tree-like design all over the place. Think of the air passages in the human lung.
Tree-shaped.
Electrical power grids.
Tree-shaped.
Roads and highways.
The vascularization of the retina. The
snowflakes?
Yes, it is the same with the growth of any snowflake.
Anything that facilitates flowing follows the constructal law.
The snowflake is tree-shaped because it is a flow system for the flow of heat.
But it doesn't have to be physical world things like fluid or cars or heat. It can be like information is flowing,
yes,
or power is flowing.
Correct. Anything that flows, the animate, the inanimate, and our social dynamics is subject to this law and, for that matter, to any other law of physics.
And this gives us something that Ilya Prigozhin's chaos theory couldn't.
Chaos, complexity, fractal geometry, all of these things are descriptive.
But the constructal law gives us the answer to why things are the way they are and how they got to be this way.
The constructal law, among other attributes, defines what life means. Life is not a phenomenon in a narrow field such as biology. Life is a phenomenon for all physics, meaning for everything and everywhere. And to be alive means to be a flow system that is free to change its configuration over time.
So what kinds of things in our world would be dead?
Well, dead are samples of, say, crystals or solid. Dead is anything that shows absolutely no movement. For example, a sample of water in a glass tube. That is a system that is not alive.
However, if the water were exposed to air and able to evaporate, well, then it's flowing again.
That flow system is a live flow system.
Well, okay, well, let's try applying it to something else. Let's say a radio piece, because in radio, information is flowing. And how could you use the constructal law to explain that process?
Excellent. Writing is actually has become what it is today. In your case, you are writing audio by through spoken words. The writing that works has structure. It has main ideas, which are few and big, which are your questions, by the way. And on those branches, meaning on that skeleton, you hear two things. You hear my reinforcement of your own skeleton. Those are my answers to your questions. But you also hear these spontaneous additions, which are basically putting the leaves and the birds on those branches. And altogether, your report becomes not only full, but it has balance.
And then at the end, when I have the finished piece, it's dead.
Yes, yes.
But then it becomes part of another process.
Absolutely. I like your example because it's actually not dead. It's famously alive after you broadcast it. It has a life of its own. Your story is covering the globe because of a hierarchical flow system. You have special channels that first connect to you, all the way to a canopy filled by people who transmit by word of mouth. When your story is old enough, your live flow system has finally come to an end. But even then, it's alive in the earphones of some historians who would be interested to know what you discussed today.
So to all the historians out there listening in the future, don't thank me. Thank the constructal law. For Studio 360, I'm Jonathan Mitchell.
There's obviously a lot more to Bejan's theory we couldn't get to, like how it applies to the ways that companies are organized. You can read more about it in his new book, Design in Nature: How the Constructal Law Governs Evolution in Biology, Physics, Technology, and Social Organization. Are there places in the world or in your life where you see the constructal law at work? If so, tell us about those at studio360.org. And while you're at our website, do check out our blog. We've got news stories there all the time, including one this week, a profile of Roger Shimomura from Kansas City. He's a Japanese-American painter who creates these fantastical mashups of the two cultures, such as Wonder Woman battling a samurai, or George Washington and his men crossing the Delaware in kimonos. Take a look at studio360.org. Coming up, the writer Pico Iyer has spent most of his life traveling around the world. But it was the author Graham Greene, a man he never met, who made him feel most at home.
It was like being in a very lonely place and suddenly realizing that I have a companion.
Pico Iyer on the writer Graham Greene. That's ahead in Studio 360. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
Traveling alone is a wonderful thing. Traveling alone is a wonderful thing.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. When I was 13, one of the first grown-up novels I ever chose to read that wasn't assigned in school was The Power and the Glory by Graham Greene. It's about a sinful but decent and loving Roman Catholic priest in Mexico. As a kid who thought that religious faith was something simple, simplistic, it was mind-blowing. An exciting story with these deep philosophical concerns. Greene wrote more than two dozen novels between the 1920s and the 1980s, most of them set in sketchy places around the world. Downbeat bestsellers that got made into lots of movies, like The Third Man, The Quiet American, Our Man in Havana, and more. My Graham Greene fandom doesn't even come close to Pico Iyer's. My friend Pico is, like Greene, an Oxford-educated Brit who travels a lot to sketchy foreign places that he writes about. And I realized a while ago that this writer, born a half century before him, is his virtual father. So he has written a new book about that called The Man Within My Head. Pico, welcome back to Studio 360.
Really nice to be here again, Kurt.
When and why and how did Graham Greene's books and life become so central to your life? It seems as though Graham Greene is your rosebud in the Citizen Kane sense.
I think it was when I first began to travel, actually, maybe in my mid-20s, because, as you know, to anybody who's sitting in a hotel in a foreign city which he can't really understand, Graham Greene is the patron saint of that condition or that predicament. I think it was only when maybe I first began going to Havana that I saw that he caught Cuba in 1987, from having been there 30 years before, better than any guidebook I could summon.
In his novel, Our Man in Havana.
Exactly.
And so at that point, when you're 30 years old, is that the moment when this kind of Graham Greene explanation for your life, for your peripatetic life and traveling to dodgy Bolivian mountain towns and so forth become clear to you? I mean, was it like an aha moment about Greene?
No, it was like being in a very lonely place and suddenly realizing that I have a companion. And it only took maybe years of reading and what felt like conversation with him to understand how deep that companionship was and what a great friend he would turn out to be. I remember, I mean, for example, one moment I was in this little town called Santiago de Cuba, and I walked out of a small hotel called the Casa Grande, and I got into a car to look around, and at the minute I did, a stranger slipped into the passenger seat, promised to show me around, which was disconcerting. More disconcerting when he said his name was Faust. But most disconcerting, when I went back to California after that, I was reading a biography of Graham Greene. I found that 35 years before he had been in this little town of Santiago de Cuba. He'd stayed in the tiny Hotel Casa Grande. He had slipped out one day to look around, got into a car, and a stranger had slipped in, promising to show him around. And those kind of eerie correspondences, which happened again and again, began to make me think there must be some deeper sense of connection, that almost as if he was scripting my life, or I was just stumbling through one of his novels.
And yet you are, among other things, a rationalist. You're not somebody who naturally believes in my experience, in sort of new age synchronicity, but this seems to have been the thing, one instance of that in your life, because it kept happening again and again, where you began to sort of take it seriously.
That's right. I mean, I kept on reading that same biography, and suddenly Graham Greene came up with this crazy idea of writing a play about a very obscure 19th century romantic painter and diarist, Benjamin Robert Hayden, and I couldn't help but recall at the end of the 1970s, when I was a wide-eyed graduate student, I came up with a totally crazy idea of writing a doctoral dissertation on, of course, a very obscure 19th century romantic painter and diarist, Benjamin Robert Hayden. And
wow.
I love what you said. When you said I was a rationalist, I am. And I think one of the deeper correspondences is my sense that Graham Greene was a skeptic who suddenly felt himself surrounded by mystery and realized that skepticism couldn't answer all his questions, even though he couldn't subscribe to faith. And so I was a rationalist who was turned on my head by these convergences and began to wonder, what is it that lies outside my explanation and how far can I move away from my rationalism almost?
The other man within your head, whose picture is on the cover of the book along with Greene, is your father. He was, I discovered in fullness from this book, this extraordinary figure who was this prodigy in Bombay, went to Oxford, came to the United States, was this almost cultishly adored professor, philosopher, superstar in Santa Barbara in the late 60s and 70s. He was, it seemed, from your description of his philosophy and his sensibility and his work, kind of had a pretty deep mystic streak as well, yeah?
Exactly. And I saw him really as a passionate figure and a man of fervor and a man of great belief. And so I suppose Graham Greene spoke for the skeptic and the doubter in me. And as I went back and forth between them in my head, I remembered how from the age of 9, I was going back and forth 6 times a year between my father's house in 60s California, where the kids down the street were burning down the Bank of America and kind of raising to the ground all foundations of society as we knew it, and the sort of Graham Greene world of my boarding school, which was set up in the 15th century and where we had to write poems in dead languages and wear morning dress to class. And
is the famous Eton, which is the very picture, archetype, stereotype of English posh.
Yes, and I realized that going back and forth, I was really going back and forth between different parts of my mind, between mm-hmm. the skepticism that England trained us in very rigorously and this great California 60s surrender to the unknown and possibility that my father represented. And when we meet somebody who entrances us or when we go to a foreign place, we're sort of asking, how much should I give myself over to this unknown or how much should I remain on guard? And so I suppose Greene and my father came to stand for those two opposing poles.
Looking back at your 9-year-old self in 1966, deciding to do this, commuting to Eton from Santa Barbara, I mean, which is just, ever since I've learned this fact, I found it extraordinary. do you, considering your 9-year-old self, making that choice, saying, oh, this would be more affordable than going to this school here, I'll fly every couple of months back and forth between England and California. Does that seem bizarre that you little Pico, made that choice?
It does begin to seem bizarre to me now. Of course, at the age of 9, I figured I knew everything, and I was full of crazy self-confidence. But now, 9 years old seems very young, and you're not the only one of my friends to be very surprised to learn in this book that it was me that made that decision. And I think it's because I began my schooling at the Dragon School in Oxford, and then suddenly when I was 7, my parents moved to the New World and this other planet known as California in the 60s. And I think at some subliminal level, I must have felt I was more comfortable with the devil I knew, this rigorous kind of masochistic training in ancient English boarding school, than with the formlessness and vacancy of this society that was in the midst of becoming California. And wow. I suppose at that early age, I thought better to have solid foundations and then to explore on the basis of that than to build your life on quicksand, which is how California seemed to me. So I'm glad I made that choice. And of course, going to a school alone, flying back and forth by myself, being 6,000 miles from my parents or any other relatives, in certain ways trained me for what's happened ever since, which is being a writer and traveling and being pretty much on my own. So I willy-nilly, I created, I suppose, the blueprint for my traveling life there.
As a critic, a person who's been educated in literature at Harvard and Oxford and elsewhere, how do you regard Graham Greene as a writer? Is he one of your favorites, or is he just somebody whose life happened to intersect with yours at all these points?
He is one of my favorites, and I think he's underrated in the academy only for two reasons, really, which is that he's very readable and he's very popular. And I think the reason that he holds readers, even today, is he speaks for something very deep and archetypal. I've read his book, The Quiet American, probably 15 times now.
Wow.
Each time, yeah, and each time I get more out of it. And
that's the one set in Vietnam in the 50s.
Exactly. And I would say, although set and written in Vietnam and published in 1955, if you want to know what's going to happen in Afghanistan 2 years from now, or if you want to know what happened in Iraq 5 years ago, the book to read still is The Quiet American, set in Vietnam in 1955. And I think, as you know, it tells this elaborate public story about the dance of empires, the British Empire realizing in the 1950s its power is behind it, the American Empire striding into Vietnam, determined to remake this ancient society in the light of the theories of Harvard Square. But even as it's unfolding this very public political story, it's also, to me, telling this rendingly private story just about three breathing individuals who are kind of wavering between realism and romance. Each one of those characters doesn't know how much to give his or her heart and how much to hold back. And for any author to tell a prophetic political story, to unfold a deep and heartbreaking emotional story, and to knit them together in fewer than 200 pages, I think it's a kind of feat of technical virtuosity.
Well, and in this age, political age, where people, the age of evil, the axis of evil and evildoers and people just domestically regarding their opponents with such viciousness, reading Greene, it seems to me, is a good thing to do at this moment because nobody is entirely good or bad, right? I mean, evil of any extreme and pure kind is almost non-existent in the novels of Graham Greene.
Oh, I love the fact you said that. Exactly. I think he said famously once that the world has no black and white, it's just 1,000 shades of gray. And I think exactly as you said, what he was doing in all his books was dismantling the idea of an enemy. He was very tough on any character who resembled Graham Greene, and very kind and sympathetic towards everybody else, especially the person you think of as the bad guy. As you say, I think there are no bad guys in Graham Greene, even though there are no really good guys.
And having read The Quiet American 15 times and presumably Greene's other novels many times, in the next 30 years of your time on this earth, are you going to keep reading them?
Yes, you know, the strange thing, I spent 8 years on this book, and the thing surprising even to me now is I would gladly spend the rest of my life just reading and rereading them forever. You know, here in California where I'm sitting, secrets are usually associated with the bad part of our life, that we're quiet about our sins and our transgressions, our betrayals. What's interesting about Greene, which goes back to that Harry Potter world we were discussing in England, is that his characters are secret mostly about their acts of conscience and their saintliness. They present themselves to the world as sinners, but secretly behind closed doors, they're doing acts of great heroism. And I like that. I think that's a good way of navigating the world.
Pico Iyer, it is always a pleasure. And if I had my choice, we would simply create a radio show where you and I would talk for an hour a day or about whatever we wished. But we don't have that luxury right now. Thanks so much for talking today.
Thank you. It's always a delight. Thank you, Kurt.
Pico Iyer's new book is called The Man Within My Head, and it's out now. Graham Greene's books obviously changed Pico Iyer's life. From time to time, we ask listeners if there's some work of art that changed their lives. Daniel Egan is a film critic who has loved movies since he was a little kid. He'd watch them on Saturday mornings with his dad.
I was probably 6 years old. I was seated on the floor at the foot of my father's bed, where the only television was in our house.
And that's where he discovered Preston Sturgis's terrific 1941 movie, Sullivan's Travels.
Sullivan's Travels is about a film director, John Sullivan, who is fed up with making inconsequential comedies, and he wants to set out to make a movie that's going to make a difference with people's lives.
I wanted to make you something outstanding, something you could be proud of, something that would realize the potentialities of film as the sociological and artistic medium that it is.
He talks to his studio executives who are appalled.
And all I'm asking you is, what do you know about hard
yes.
luck?
Yes. What do you mean, what do I know about hard luck? Don't you think
no.
I've... What?
You have not.
But I'll tell you what I'm going to do first. I'm going down to the wardrobe and get some old clothes, some old shoes.
Huh?
He's going to dress up as a hobo in order to find out what poverty is really like.
I don't know where I'm going, but I'm not coming back till I know what trouble is.
He ends up going on 3 or 4 different journeys in order to try and find the reality of poverty. And once Sullivan feels that he's learned enough from the homeless people, he gathers together a couple $100 in $5 bills to hand out to people on sidewalks, the homeless and bread lines, things like that. There is one person he gives money to, a bearded tramp, who starts following him. Both of them are just dark figures in the shadows. They end up on a station platform, and the tramp hits him over the head with a brick. He rifles through his clothes, gets his money, and then tries to flee. He's trying to stuff the money in the pockets when suddenly we see the light of an approaching train. It's a terrible situation because he can't go left, he can't go right. Anywhere he goes, he's going to get killed. He throws his hands up, and then he's dead. When I saw it as a child, the film gave me nightmares. That scene in particular gave me nightmares. I think what troubled me the most about it was the fact that there was no escape. The idea that no matter what choice you made in a situation in life with people, it would be the wrong one. There was no right choice to make. You were still going to be punished or get caught or lose your way. As a child, you think that these incidents in films are real and they're scary. When you get older, I was trying to find what gave me that initial fear, that initial enjoyment in film, and that's when I decided to study how things were put together to make a film achieve those effects. I tried making films and made as many films as I could. But it's a very expensive hobby. I got deeply into debt and realized that no one was going to give me millions of dollars to make movies, so I had to find another way to earn some money. And I found work at studios in New York City, Warner Brothers, MGM, places like that. But pre-production is a very disillusioning process. You say no more than you say yes. 9 out of 10 screenplays that are purchased are never filmed. And that it was just, I was reaching a point where it had become a business and it was no longer magic anymore. I think about not being able to make the right choice constantly. I feel, as a matter of fact, that I've wasted a lot of my life waiting for someone to decide things for me. And now I'm in a position where I have to make the decision, I have to make a choice, or have it thrust on me. I find that there's a sense of dissatisfaction in Sturges' work, which I relate to very much, in a way that goes beyond actually the filmmaking process.
I wanted to make you something outstanding, something you could be proud of, something that would realize the potentialities of film as the sociological and artistic medium that it is.
If I look back on it now, I think the point Sturges is trying to make is John Sullivan's destiny is to make terrible comedies. That's his destiny in life, and he's trapped into doing it just like the tramp is trapped into being killed by society. Sturges was deeply ambivalent about his role as a director, and so to make a film about a director who's ambivalent about his own role is a very daring thing to do at that time, I think. You know, I don't want to parallel myself with Sturges' life, but he had a lot of setbacks and he was knocked down a lot of times, but he kept finding a way to progress.
Film critic Daniel Egan on the 1941 movie Sullivan's Travels. Egan writes a film blog for Smithsonian Magazine called Real Culture, and he's the author of America's Film Legacy 2009-2010, A Viewer's Guide. Studio 360's Jenny Lawton produced our story with Katie Long. Is there some movie that changed your life like that, or maybe a book or a song or a TV show? If so, tell us about it at studio360.org. And that is it for today's show. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen next week. And in the meantime, you can find us on both Facebook and Twitter, Twitter at Studio 360 Show. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper,
Rebecca Lee Douglas,
Thomas Seeley,
Krista Ripple.
And thanks this week, as every week, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you? And by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Studio 360's series on creativity and science is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information is online at sloan.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Next time in Studio 360, the actor Will Ferrell.
We don't have a whole lot of songs that feature the cowbell.
He's goofy, he's fearless, and now he's a leading man acting entirely in Spanish.
Quiero a la muchacha, déjala ir.
That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.